So our goal is just to continue to raise awareness on the shoddy nature of the research behind these claims. Consumers deserve information, but that information should be accurate.
Welcome to Wine and Health, a new podcast channel from Drinks Insider. In this occasional series, I'm going to do a deep dive into wine, health, and health policy. What do we know for certain, and what don't we know, and how is this information being used? Come on this journey into a world where evidence, uncertainty, and public health collide. How much alcohol is safe to drink? At the moment, the US government says 2 drinks a day for men and 1 for women, but that could be about to change. The US is reconsidering its dietary guidelines right now, and the committee doing the work is expected to make new recommendations about how much alcohol is safe. But the way their work is unfolding has caused some controversy. David Clement of Canada's Consumer Choice Centre watched the exact same fight unfold in Canada in 2023, involving some of the same people over some of the same issues. So here's the background before we begin. So, as I said, the US is currently revising its alcohol guidelines. They say the current safe level of drinking is 2 drinks a day and 1 for women. The US committee doing the work includes 3 Canadians who were involved in Canada's guidelines in 2023. Previously, the Canadian government had said it was safe for men to have 15 drinks a week and women to have 10. But the committee revised that safe drinking level down to just 2 drinks a week in total. Now, this caused an outcry, including from addiction specialists, and the guidelines were never adopted. David Clement wrote a number of articles for the Canadian media about what went wrong. In his work, he discovered that 2 of the Canadian researchers had volunteered for Movendi, the Swedish temperance group that's reinvented itself as a public NGO. I've written up the whole story for Wine Business Monthly, and I'll drop the link in the show notes. But a word about what you're about to hear. This interview jumps about in a couple of places because David and I discussed some specific researchers. The podcast format makes it impossible to offer a proper right of reply, and I didn't think it was fair, so I've cut that part out. But all of this will be in the Drinks Insider newsletter, which you can sign up for at drinksinsider.com. David, let's start straight away with the USDA guidelines. Why is alcohol being considered separately from diet?
Well, it's a good question. I think that part of the reason is the increased focus on alcohol consumption in regards to the pandemic. So there's been a bit of a push to have it separated in the context of evaluating it on its own, in the same way that other things are outside of what we consider diet. There are ongoing questions, which we are about to get into in terms of the benefit, lack of benefit, or risk associated with alcohol use. And then I think the second factor here is there's just been a lot of increased pressure from NGOs who have really set their sights on alcohol consumption more generally. And so I think the combination of the two has created this situation where we may have guidelines that are kind of taken out of the conversation about diet.
Okay, so before we get into all of that, you're Canadian and you're from the Consumer Choice Centre. Who are you and who do you represent?
So as you mentioned, I am Canadian, based in the Toronto area. The Consumer Choice Centre is an international consumer advocacy group. We have been around for 8 years now. We have staff all over the world, and we work on issues that touch on the issue of consumer choice. I believe we probably have over 100,000 or so supporters throughout our various campaigns around the world. We obviously talk about alcohol, but we've also done extensive work on all sorts of issues, everything from free trade to cannabis policy to agricultural and food policy. So whenever a major regulatory issue touches or hits consumers in areas where they like access to the things that they like, we speak up on behalf of those consumers and give those folks a voice Because more often than not, in a lot of these policy discussions, how policy impacts consumers is often forgotten about or ignored. And so our goal is to try and continue to represent those consumers at the state, national, and international level, wherever we can.
And who funds you?
So the CCC is funded through a variety of sources, individuals, philanthropic charities or trusts, as well as corporate partnerships or corporate donors. We put all of this on our website. We're very forthright in terms of where we get support. But what we don't do is we don't take any editorial discretion from any donor, individual, philanthropic, or corporate. We don't take any editorial direction from anyone who supports us on any issue. And we're very strident in terms of ensuring that what we do is represent consumers. And that's our priority.
So to somebody listening to this who goes, oh, okay, so he's a shill for big business or big alcohol, what would you say?
I mean, I've certainly heard that a lot. We also go up against big business often, as one would assume a consumer organization does. I mean, if on the topic of alcohol, because that's what we're talking about today, we've been at odds with the alcohol industry in Canada for the better part of the last 5 years. We partnered with the provincial government in Ontario to try and rip up the what's called the Beer Store, which is a private entity that's existed since the end of Prohibition that gives the big three brewers a monopoly on the sale of cases of beer. That's a very anti-consumer monopoly that's existed for 100 years. We pushed back and fought tooth and nail against industry on that issue extensively and won. That monopoly is going away. It is expiring. It's been far too long. But anyone who thinks that we just advocate on behalf of industry probably hasn't looked at the issues where we've battled the industry on, and alcohol, which we're talking about, is a prime example of that.
All right. So you're Canadian, as we've just established, and I'm Australian and I live in Europe. So why should any of us care about what happens in the US? What are the potential international consequences for, you know, the Americans changing their guidelines around alcohol?
Well, it matters because it's one of the biggest markets, and they're, in many instances, a trendsetter. They can be a trendsetter. And so I would say it's about precedent setting when you have such a large market, both in terms of the production of the beverages that people like, but also a large market in terms of the people who consume them. It matters because how this debate unfolds could have ramifications internationally as other governments look to possibly replicate what the United States has done.
Okay, can you, in a short and pithy way, sum up what this issue is and what your stance on it is and what is you're concerned about?
Yeah, so essentially a team of researchers has been put together to redo the guidelines on alcohol. And my issue is that the researchers who are involved in this have a very, very uncomfortable history in terms of being very strident, neo-temperance teetotalers. And so from the start, I have issues with how the process is beginning. And largely it's imported from Canada. And I was very heavily involved in the discussion here in Canada on the opposite side of many of these individuals about what the appropriate guidelines for alcohol consumption should be. And we can get into why I'm critical of their view.
Let's jump straight in, because what happened in Canada was, now I understand that it's not the Canadian government that's changed its recommendations, but it's the Canadian Centre for Substance Abuse that did it. Can you explain what happened in Canada and how the recommendations changed and what impact that's had?
Yeah, so the Health Canada funds the organization who created this report. And the report essentially said that Canadians shouldn't have more than two drinks per week, which was a radical shift from no more than two drinks per day. Significant reduction. I mean, that was problematic for a variety of reasons. The first reason it was a problem is it turned almost all drinkers into problematic drinkers overnight. Statistically speaking, the vast majority of Canadian drinkers don't qualify as problematic drinkers under the old guidelines. And so if they were adopted, which they weren't, which is an important distinction because even outlets like the New York Times falsely reported that these guidelines were adopted. They were not. So one, basically all drinkers become problematic drinkers overnight. Two, the conclusions that they came to, I think were really misrepresented. And they, whether on purpose or not, really skimmed over or ignored any of the potential benefits of alcohol, of moderate alcohol consumption. And I went through their risk tables and their figures, and I wrote nationally for this a handful of times in Canada, basically going through line by line and pointing out how they were framing the debate and what the reality of the risk figures were.
Yes, in fact, I think I read one of your articles where you said their own data showed that there was, you know, moderate drinking lowered the risk of diabetes and so on. Can you talk to that?
Yeah. So when you work through the CCSA's risk tables, there's a lot of upward trends and red lines. But what you also see is a decrease in risk for things like heart disease. And that's really important because on one hand, you'll have the folks at the CCSA arguing that even moderate alcohol consumption increases your risk of breast cancer, let's say by 20% or other diseases by double-digit increases. But what they never include in their reporting is the decrease in things like heart disease. And the reason why that matters, these are Canadian numbers, but I assume they're probably relatively similar across the OECD. I mean, if we look at premature deaths for something like liver cirrhosis, it's about 10.3 per 100,000. If you look at heart disease, it's 47.5 deaths per 100,000. So heart disease is the biggest killer of all of the of all of the diseases that they included in their research. And that just so happens to be the one area where moderate alcohol consumption reduces the risk. And that was just not spoken about. That was just casually ignored whenever these folks were in front of the media and meeting with policymakers. They never talked about what the benefits were. They only focused on the negatives, and they framed the negatives in a really disingenuous way in terms of how risk should be communicated to Canadians and consumers.
There was an outcry in one of the French newspapers, I think, about that. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so essentially in Quebec, there was a major pushback. There were almost 20 or so harm reduction experts who, after this was published, and it dominated the headlines for a few weeks, where all of a sudden it was saying you shouldn't have more than two drinks per week, and a lot of Canadians were wondering what changed in terms of alcohol's impact on the body between before this new report was published and after. But those researchers essentially said that the CCS report is misleading consumers. And it's a disingenuous report. They have nefarious motives, and otherwise. And so I think that's part of the reason why the CCSA's report didn't really take hold and the recommendations were not adopted, is because once it was more critically evaluated, folks started to realize that this wasn't how science is supposed to be conducted.
And yet, that report has been widely quoted on numerous times in the New York Times, mm-hmm. which is interesting. So that was one of my questions, you know, what was the fallout from the CCA recommendations? And from my point of view, it seems to have been certainly there's been a fallout as far as the media in the United States. But so what you're saying is there wasn't a big impact inside Canada itself.
Well, there was originally, right? I would say for the better part of 2 weeks, this dominated the headlines and created a bit of a national conversation. But as time wore on and people started chipping away at the research and highlighting the backgrounds of the people who were involved and some of their kind of uncomfortable associations and previous positions, it fell apart. I'd say the narrative that you can't have more than two drinks per week fell apart over the course of time. Now, the problem is, as you mentioned, that headline is still trickling down elsewhere, in this instance in the United States. And so it's important that that same level of criticism and review occur as other health agencies start to take the CCSA report at face value.
What issues do you have with these researchers?
I would caution anyone to respect people who parrot the line that no amount of alcohol is safe. People who do that are being purposely disingenuous in terms of how they communicate hazard and risks.
So, again, I'm an Australian sitting in my office. You're a Canadian sitting in your office. Who are we to criticize these researchers? Give me your reasons.
Well, I mean, going back to Movendi, if you have open ties to Movendi, Movendi used to be called the International Order of Good Templars. It's centuries old. It was a prohibitionist group. They are now a neo-temporist group. They push for as close to prohibition as they can get in all of their advocacy. They go so far as having their members swear an oath of abstinence, which is rather strange. They change their name from Movendi from the Order of International Order of Good Templars to Movendi, I think probably because the original name sounded like it was from a Dan Brown novel and there was a mystery to unsolve or something. But I'll frame it for listeners in the easiest way I can. If the FDA was going to create guidelines on how much meat Americans should eat, they would not spend money on researchers who were card-carrying members of PETA and who were vegans. That would be laughed at because everybody would know that their position isn't coming from one of evaluating the evidence. It's one where they have their pre-drawn conclusion and they're trying to gerrymander what they can to get to their pre-drawn conclusion. And that's exactly what happened with the CCSA's report, is that hypothesis bore out in real time because it was pretty clearly seen from the minute it was published that they had their position and they got the data to support it. They ignored the social engagement benefits of moderate alcohol consumption. They ignored the fact that the J curve exists. And I think that made it very easy in the Canadian context to say, okay, these folks were not honest brokers in terms of this discussion. And that is the major concern I have, is that we see this time and time again. Everything that they put out is from that abstinence-only position, which, one, is just not factual. It's also just not helpful. I mean, in the same way that abstinence-only sex education is not helpful.
So on this, what do you know about Movendi? We know that they're founded in 1851 in New York. Somehow they've ended up in Scandinavia. They're now called Movendi. What else do you know about them?
So this is the most funny thing I found in my kind of investigating of Movendi, because I was curious. I mean, anti-alcohol activism is an interesting world, and I wondered, okay, well, how do they keep the lights on? Ironically, they keep the lights on by running a lottery in Sweden. I find it a little strange that the abstinence-only Puritans fund their activism by dipping their toes into the finances of a different sin.
I have to clarify this because I read what you wrote and I went and looked it up. And there's Movendi and then there's IOGTNT, which looks to me like there's the international organization and then there's the Swedish organization and it's the Swedish branch that runs the lottery for which they've been done for bad practices.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, it's very peculiar. And interestingly, it's very hard to unravel the relationships. When you look at them, it's not always clear who they are.
It feels a little bit like a shell game, but you raise a very good point. I mean, I have no objections morally to anybody running a lottery. I do get a little irritated at the folks who lecture you about having a third beer in a week running a lottery, and that gets a lot worse when you factor in that lottery in particular has been accused of advertising to minors, of defrauding seniors, of all sorts of really egregious corporate behavior, which is hilariously enough what they accuse the alcohol industry of doing. And so it just creates this strange means for anti-alcohol activism to keep the lights on.
So here's what I've discovered about Movendi. I've spent a lot of time looking at their website, their social media. I've been listening to their podcasts. And what's really striking about them is how, one, they're very poorly funded. I mean, you can tell they're not out there doing big advocacy work. The social media is very naive. They come across as almost like idealistic, dare I say, sort of teenagers. They write ridiculous social posts about, you know, we're out here having a fun lunch together and we have a joy in life that people in big alcohol could never have. Like just very, very naive sort of writing. And when I look at it, I mean, it really looks to me like a sort of youth camp culture. And yet they have the ear of the WHO. And I've been trying to understand how those two things go together. And I've got no idea. How does a group like Movendi end up advising the WHO? Have you got any idea?
That's a great question. I wish I had the answer, but it is important that when you talk about their social media or online presence, that really doesn't matter so much if you actually have the ear of policymakers. So it's not like they're out there trying to convince citizens not to drink. That would be a totally fine thing for them to do if they were trying to win in the battle of ideas and influence public opinion. They don't seem very interested or very good at influencing public opinion. And yet, and so the other side of that coin is, well, how do we grab the attention and the ears of those regulators who make the rules rather than convincing the population at large that we're right?
Yeah, I've skipped a point in the story, but the point of this is when you read WHO documents from 2018 onwards to do with alcohol, you find that one of the partners is Movendi and other groups, which also began as temperance groups. And I've been doing my best to unravel how this thing led to that thing, and I cannot for the life of me understand how, how what's basically an ex bunch of Freemasons is ending up talking to the WHO. And I'd love, if anybody knows the answer to that, let me know, because I've got no idea.
Yeah, neither do I. I mean, the only, I could speculate.
Go on, speculate, and we'll flag it as speculation.
I'm speculating, but I mean, one of the criticisms of the WHO has been mission creep and drifting away from what some may argue as its core mandate in terms of pandemics and infectious disease and things like that. And as you have that mission creep, you look for voices to fit a particular narrative, and groups like Movendi and the other temperance organizations do. So that may have been one path, but again, that's something that you can't see from the outside, and it's hard. No, you certainly, yeah, you see this in the NGO charity world, where if something is accomplished, do you just close up shop and shut it down and pat yourself on the back for a job well done? Or do you move on to some other cause? And more often than not, I mean, this includes all charities, I would argue, not just public health, but more often than not, what you see is that mission creep, and they end up going on to another issue. And as the further they go on to other issues, the more they get divorced from whatever the original purpose of the organization was.
Yeah, it was very striking to me how many people involved in the anti-alcohol groups, particularly in Europe, used to work on anti-tobacco. You see the same names coming up again and again. And I think some of, again, we'll talk about this, but I'm speculating that some of what's happening in public health policy is people who were wildly successful against tobacco using the same, you know, same playbook against other industries.
Yep.
But again, that's my theory. We'll come back to that in a second. So let's go back to the USDA guidelines. In 2020, the federal government said there wasn't enough evidence to justify lowering the alcohol guidelines. And yet now they may be about to do that very thing. What do you think's changed?
Well, I think COVID happened and alcohol consumption understandably went up, right? It was an incredibly traumatic time for a lot of people in the U.S., depending on what state you lived in. Your options to do anything were significantly limited. And so, we saw increases in alcohol use. We would most certainly see increases in alcohol abuse. So I think that was probably what sparked the interest. But I would agree with their original position that there is not enough evidence to suggest lowering the guidelines, because those people who are suggesting to lower the guidelines to 2 drinks per week are doing so in a very shoddy and incomplete way.
Well, let's talk about that, because some of the research that's coming out on the harms of alcohol has changed people's minds. For example, Tim Stockwell in 2023 published a paper with Tim Namai and a statistician in Dharma Network that said the previous J-curve research hadn't adequately accounted for the sick quitter effect. Now, let me just explain what that is. So the J-curve is a phenomenon that's noted that when people drink small or moderate amounts of alcohol, their all-cause mortality is lower than people who either don't drink or who drink too much. And it's always been a confounding variable that people who drink moderately do better against people who don't drink at all. And what Tim Stockwell has argued is that there is a sick quitter, when he wasn't the first person to do this, but his new paper apparently proves that the reason people weren't drinking was because they were so sick, their doctors told them they couldn't drink, and that's why they had worse outcomes. So that paper came out last year, and that is informing a lot of what is sort of being discussed at the moment. So what's your problem with that?
Well, I mean, in 2005, there was a study based on 23 years of data that replicated the results of previous research and disproved the sick quitter hypothesis by comparing lifelong non-drinkers with moderate drinkers. And so it found that moderate drinkers had a 19% lower mortality risk and a 28% lower risk of heart disease. So, I mean, it's a very catchy way of trying to discredit your critics, but I don't think it's particularly convincing given that one, it's not particularly accurate. The sick quitter hypothesis has been tested in various research models going back decades. So it's just a useful way of trying to conveniently silence the critics more often than not with people who aren't necessarily up to speed with the history and the depth of the research already on the topic. And so I'm very skeptical of Stockwell's claim that those papers didn't account for the sick quitter effect, when we have it well documented in numerous other instances across different societies as well, which is important, different demographics, that the J-curve does exist. Now, the J-curve doesn't mean that you should drink if you don't, but it certainly does chip a huge hole in the ideology that there is no safe amount of alcohol and that alcohol needs to be avoided at all costs. It definitely negates much of what these neo-temperist researchers have been pushing for 20 years.
Okay, so in some of your pieces, when you've pushed back against this, you've quoted people from the International Scientific Forum on Alcohol. Who are they, and why should anybody care about them, particularly since their website has disappeared?
Well, they were a group of researchers, academics, who looked at the issue of alcohol harms. They have a depth of academics who work on this for a living, who aren't coming at this from the perspective, the pre-drawn conclusion that all alcohol is bad no matter what. I certainly would put them in the category of more honest brokers in terms of the alcohol's impact on the body. It's not like they're researchers who are saying, nope, there's no issue with any type of alcohol consumption. There is no risk. They're not the types of folks who have their head in the sand who are ignoring the potential for abuse or for harms. Those people shouldn't be listened to either. And so that's who they are. I can't speak to their website being down, but the professors and academics who had been involved in that had a long history of approaching this in the true scientific method of testing hypotheses and trying to get to the answer to the big questions that we have in a way that is just fundamentally different than what the folks who are affiliated with Movendi are doing.
Okay, so sure, moderate drinking may have an effect in some people for lowering risk for heart disease or diabetes. But if you look at the current statistics around alcohol, it's clear that the pandemic caused, you know, major problems, that the level of alcohol harms is rising, from liver problems in women to, you know, deaths related to alcohol. So isn't it time for government and health bodies to take very serious action?
Probably not, because as much as there was that spike, we are also seeing now a serious downward trend in alcohol consumption, especially if you look at it based on age. So younger people drink less than in America, drink less than they used to, and that's continuing to go down. Alcohol consumption per capita, was lower in 2022. Than it was in 2021. And so I think you probably have to wait for that equalization post-COVID, where life goes back to normal. We're not all in our houses with nothing to do. And so naturally, some end up abusing alcohol. But I also think that the purpose here, in terms of those statistics that you mentioned, that's the appropriate conversation for alcohol policy, is the fraction of adults who abuse alcohol. How do we help those people? How do we nudge them to lower risk alternatives to non-alcoholic beverages? How do we get them away from the problematic drinking behavior that they have? Now, that's not the perspective of the people on the other side of this debate, because they apply their lens to everyone. The folks who don't fall into the categories of generating liver issues later in life or generating significantly higher cancer risk, that's the majority of drinkers. They don't fall into these problematic categories.
I think they would probably argue that, or in fact, they are arguing that one of the tactics that they're trying is to denormalize alcohol the way that tobacco was denormalized. That if you can't see people around drinking, if there are fewer places where you can drink, that everybody will be better off because everybody's consumption will be lower, including those people who have a problem with alcohol.
Yeah, but you don't need to lower everyone's consumption of alcohol unless you view all alcohol consumption as bad. You may want to limit alcohol consumption for alcoholics. That's a noble goal, and I'm with you. I'm with them on that front. But to try and lump in responsible drinkers with those who are alcoholics or severe binge drinkers or who abuse alcohol is incredibly paternalistic, and I would argue that their guidelines are counterproductive, and they're counterproductive in the sense, and we saw this in real time in Canada because the various news agencies did street interviews with Canadians to be like, what do you think about the new guidelines of 2 drinks per week? And everyone was like, what, 2 drinks per week? Give me a break. And what that does is when the guidelines are so divorced from reality, they drive people to just ignore public health suggestions entirely, because they don't view the suggestion as coming from an honest place or one that's even remotely realistic. And so we see that in real time in Canada, we did, with the 2 drinks per week suggestion, is people were like, oh, well, obviously these people are ridiculous, so why am I going to listen to them? That's not good either, because there are guidelines, and guidelines should be there for, should be one, based on science, and two, there for the right reasons.
And yet, the WHO in particular has come out and said that no level of alcohol is safe. So what would your reaction to that be?
They're miscommunicating, whether on purpose or not, the difference between hazards and risks. So a hazard is the potential of something bad happening, right? The sun is a hazard. If we could eliminate all skin cancer if nobody went outside ever again. That is, of course, true. But it's about risk, which is the exposure to that hazard. And so the idea that no level of alcohol is safe is conflating the two. It depends on how much you drink, when, your own personal physiological being, whether you're male or female, there are different outcomes. There are different outcomes along all sorts of different factors that are included in someone's health. And so the idea that there is no safe amount of alcohol is just a really strange way of communicating it. Because again, even the CCSA's research shows that in the context of what ordinary people would consider safe, I'll give you an example. The risk of, let's say, something like breast cancer, serious illness. 14 drinks per week for women increases your risk of breast cancer by 0.0048, so 0.04%. In the context of everything else we do in our lives, that is safe. That is not a risk worth being overly concerned about. I made the joke publicly here that it's probably more risky driving to the liquor store in a car than it is to consume to the old guidelines.
This word cancer cuts to the heart of this. So one of the things that the WHO said in its press release is there might be a cardiovascular risk, you know, lowering of risk or lowering of risk for diabetes, but you'll basically pay for it in potential for cancer. They didn't use those words, but that was the implication. So now we have a number of jurisdictions, including Ireland in 2026, planning on putting cancer warnings on alcohol. I mean, alcohol is a grade one carcinogen, as the IRCS has said. So why or why not? Do you support the idea of putting cancer warnings on alcohol or not?
No, I don't. I don't, because it falsely equates, in almost all jurisdictions where there are cancer warnings on tobacco, it falsely equates the risk with that of tobacco. So you got to remember that consumers, when they see cancer warnings on alcohol, will go, oh, well, I've seen these warnings before on smoking or on cigarettes. And smoking does cause cancer. We all know that. And that's a false equivalence. That's super problematic. It sends the wrong message to consumers in a very fear-mongering and inaccurate way when you look at the absolute change in risk. And I mean, if somebody from the WHO was going to try and make the argument that you might pay for it later in life with cancer risk, the numbers don't really bear that out for moderate drinkers, for people who consume responsibly within the no more than 14 drinks per week guideline. And that's mostly because if you just look at premature deaths, the major killer premature death-wise of everything that's evaluated in this equation, the major killer is heart disease. It's not some of these other cancers. And those cancers are serious and they're scary. But again, should you have a colorectal cancer warning on a beer for a fraction of a 100% increase in risk? I don't think so. I don't think that that's appropriate public health messaging.
Yeah, and I should make something else clear, which is the IARC's grade one carcinogen is not saying as has often been reported, that the grade ones include asbestos, tobacco and radiation and alcohol. They're not saying these things are equivalent. They're saying their level of certainty that at some point these things are carcinogenic.
Yeah, and yes, if you drink a case of beer a day, that is certainly going to increase your risk of all of the things that we've talked about. The question.
But if you breathe in asbestos once, you're probably going to be in a bad way.
Well, yes, and that's why I said it falsely equates it to things that are more serious and more direct, like smoking. When they're not, they're just fundamentally different. The risk profile of moderate alcohol consumption is in another world compared to that of smoking, or even worse, something like asbestos. And so it creates this false equivalency, and that's a huge problem in terms of accurate public health messaging.
Let's talk about something else. I don't know if you read the recent WHO document on the commercial determinants of health, but it does look from the outside as though the public health lobby is applying the anti-tobacco playbook, not simply against alcohol, but against many different things. What's your perception?
Yeah, it is. I mean, gambling is now apparently a public health crisis.
Well, gambling does do pretty terrible things to people.
It certainly can, but I think there'd be serious questions of whether gambling is in the mandate of the WHO. I mean, we saw this with statements in regards to video games, which was, of course, pretty quickly debunked. We've seen this. We saw this in the U.S., in the South, and with predominantly Republican legislators at the time puppeting the idea that video games were making people violent based on some anecdotes, and that's not necessarily true. It's that mission creep we first spoke about, where it's, okay, well, what can we focus on now to keep us relevant and to keep us in the mix? And I have major concerns with that. And I have major concerns with that in the context of, has the WHO done a particularly good job of handling Ebola outbreaks in Africa? That is a debate. Did they do
it? Yeah, actually, the head of the WHO, when there was one Ebola outbreak, was actually at an anti-tobacco conference in Russia.
Yeah.
Rather than handling it. That's a famous example of.
Yeah. And I mean, though, did the WHO do a. Were the WHO guidelines on masks, when they first said that they didn't work, was that effective? Was it good? Did they handle that well? Probably not. Did the WHO statements on the airborne nature of the virus help or hurt our ability to curb the spread of COVID-19? They got that wrong. I would much prefer to have the WHO get the big questions right rather than have it creep away from its original core values and the importance of vaccination and eliminating some of the major diseases that are now, for the most part, behind us. I'd much rather that than it dip its claws into things like alcohol policy in this really nefarious way, or gambling or video games or all of the other things that they seem just dedicated to try and use the tobacco playbook model to clamp down on.
So why do you think the anti-alcohol movement is being so successful right now? Is it simply COVID, or is it the accumulated weight of scientific evidence? Or what's the reason? Because we're hearing more from the anti-alcohol lobby than we have ever before, I think.
That's a good question. I mean, probably predominantly COVID, because that really brought it. I mean, COVID and economic circumstances that can lead to increases in problematic drinking. That was their hook, their in, to insert themselves back into the policy conversation. Because I don't really think they would have been taken seriously in this way 10 years ago. But they had their hook in the same way that if there was some, for whatever reason, some moderate spike in impaired driving, they would then insert themselves to make their original point that you shouldn't touch alcohol at all. So I think it's probably COVID. I'm not convinced on on the evidence of scientific certainty that they would push, because more often than not, they're ignoring whatever the benefits are. And I mean, that raises Christopher Snowden at the IEA raised the, I think, rather astute point of, okay, so if you have to have the risks, do you have to have the benefits? Should the warning label include the lowering of heart disease cases, and how many, let's say, how many Canadians or Americans a year die from heart disease? Should it include the social engagement benefits, which is another part of the COVID discussion, is because we were removed from others for so long. I think he said it in a rather cheeky way where he was kind of giggling and laughing about it. But I mean, if we're going full tilt into, we want everything on the bottle that could potentially be a hazard, well, do you then put everything on the bottle that could be potentially a benefit?
So what is this an active issue for you and the center? Is this something that you're dealing with, or is this just something that you're watching in passing? And what are you doing?
Our goal is just to continue to raise awareness on the shoddy nature of the research behind these claims. Consumers deserve information, but that information should be accurate. And fear-mongering American drinkers in the process is just not an effective public health strategy. And it's ultimately one that's going to backfire. Harm reduction is something worth pursuing, but abstinence only or prohibition style recommendations or guidelines are just not the path to effective public health in dealing with the very serious issue of people who abuse alcohol. And so we are continued to be engaged on this in Europe, it continued in Canada, because obviously that debate isn't over, as well as in the United States as this conversation picks up. And so I'll be writing more about this for U.S. publications, just highlighting what does the research actually say? An example would be when some of the folks on the other side of this debate will say, well, it increases this type of cancer rate by 30%. But what's the baseline risk to get that, right? If they're like, oh, yeah, esophageal cancer increases by 30%. Okay, well, what does the risk table actually show? What's the baseline? How many premature deaths are there, and what would be the increase? And how is that represented in real terms? And more often than not, when you do that process, it becomes pretty clear that we're talking about minuscule increases in risk if you're a moderate drinker. And that's something that's important for Americans to know.
Okay, final thoughts?
Final thoughts. I'm getting tired of the paternalism, of the nanny state antics from all levels of government who just increasingly want to limit the choices that Americans, Canadians, Europeans have when they're not harming other people and when they are arguably not really harming themselves. That is when I feel public health has gone too far. When we're lecturing people about saying don't have more than two drinks per week, I think we've probably gone too far. It's completely divorced from reality. And the, in air quotes, science that the folks who are affiliated with Movendi used to push this nonsense is incomplete. It's incomplete. And I just don't think that they're honest brokers, and more citizens should know that before they see the headlines of whatever the guidelines end up being.
All right. Well, look, thank you so much for talking about this. It's really interesting.
Thank you very much for having me. Really appreciate it.
You've been listening to Drinks Insider, the podcast that explores the intersection of beverages and commerce. Now, if you would like a summary of this episode, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter, which sends you the takeaways. Just go to drinksinsider.com and add your name. And if there's something you think we should be talking about, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. And before you go, please don't forget to rate this podcast. 5 stars are most welcome.